Welcome back to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Cal 1020, which is coming up on Sunday, February 15th, 2015. 10 miles, 20 bands, cal1020.com. Core Sports, the best in women's active wear. Challenge Athlete Foundation, our San Diego Triathlon Challenge coming up on October 19th. And, of course, you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes at Babbittville Radio. Our next guest, seriously, one of our favorite people on the planet. She's won 6 world championships from skiing to adventure racing to mountain biking, you name it. She's won the Leadville 100 4 times, which is one of the most brutal events around. Rebecca Rush, who is also a brand new author with Rush to Glory, joins us. Rebecca, how the heck are you?
How's it going? I'm great, thanks.
It's been a while.
It has. I think San Diego, last time I saw you, somewhere down there.
Maybe at our, it was after
Endurance
our...
Endurance Sports Awards.
Was it Endurance Awards the last time?
Yeah.
It probably was.
I think so.
Wow, downtown San Diego, I do remember that. That was awesome. So, Rebecca, let's go back. Growing up, now we know about all your sports now. What were your sports growing up?
Well, tomboy as a kid, you know, I loved to camp out in the backyard shovel snow and mow the lawn. You know, that was my outdoor adventure growing up in suburbs of Chicago. But my first organized sports was cross-country running in high school. I got involved with the team there and really kind of changed the trajectory of my life. And, you know, the teammates and the camaraderie and all that stuff was something that I really latched onto, and I kind of never looked back.
And so did that lead to running in college?
I ran in college for a short time and then sort of had a bad experience with an awful running coach and quit the team and got a road bike and, you know, taught aerobics for a while and, you know, stayed in fitness. And then it wasn't, again, until I found rock climbing that I found another sport that I was super passionate about. And that led to paddling and adventure racing, skiing, and eventually mountain biking is sort of the latest iteration of sport.
You know what's funny is you mention adventure racing to people now, and they look at you cross-eyed. You know, there's Spartan Race, there's Tough Mudder, there's all this stuff that's out there now. My Muddy Buddy series from before, but adventure racing, especially when you looked at the Raid Galois and the Eco Challenge and some of those multiple day 300-mile adventures where you really had no idea, right? You know you're kayaking, you know you're mountain biking, you know you're hiking, but you don't really know when, where, how. And you basically, the clock starts, and the first one he gets from point A to point B wins.
Do
you remember your first one?
Yeah,
remember
nobody knows what that sport is anymore.
No, but, yeah.
You know, like you said, you knew you were going to be doing those different disciplines, but you also knew for sure you were going to be lost, you were going to be hungry, you were going to get mad at your teammates, you were going to cry, you know, you were going to laugh. It really was this whole, you know, admiration of life and everything you could experience in 1 week. And, yeah, the races were 7 days nonstop with sleep deprivation and, you know, being in a foreign country and getting leeches and, you know, all sorts of things all rolled up into on top of being athletically good at all, you know, 7 different sports all at the same time.
God, what was the weirdest thing or funniest thing that happened during one of those adventure races?
You know, I tell a lot of these stories in the book.
Good.
And, you know, which is, you know, people are like, well, I had no idea you did all that stuff. But, you know, really the most special thing about it was the team dynamic that developed. I mean, you spend that long with people being cold and hungry and lost and afraid, and you really develop this bond that, you know, you don't get on a hour run or a couple-hour mountain bike ride. You know, you just don't get to that level of trust with somebody. So that was a pretty amazing part of the sport. And then also the international travel was just outrageous. I mean, we would stay in people's, you know, in a thatched hut of these people, you know, maybe in Borneo, who'd never seen an automobile, let alone people in Lycra with backpacks and, you know, hiking poles and all this shiny stuff. But they would welcome you into their homes and they'd give you the last little bit of food on their table. And so that the international travel and the interaction with sort of humans all over the world was really exciting.
You know what's interesting? Mark Burnett, who obviously has gone on to major fame with Shark Tank and with Survivor and, you know, reality shows, when I had him on the radio show once talking about what he loved about Eco Challenge, which is, you know, the multiple day event, he said he loved walking in front of the group before the start of the race the first day and looking in people's eyes and knowing that people who had been friends their entire life within 24 hours would never speak again. I just remember that. That he just loved the whole petri dish of just, you know, the racing was great, but it's like, wait till they get tired and hungry and upset and just watch the chemical reaction.
It is, and, you know, it's truly a lesson, and probably, you know, that's where my PhD is, in being patient and not giving up and being nice to people and forgiving myself, you know, if I fail or succeed. You know, all those life lessons really were built into Eco Challenge and the Raid Gawaz and those kind of races. It definitely, I mean, bike racing is hard, don't get me wrong, but I at least know I'm going to be in a bed that night, you know, or maybe even the next day, and I'm going to have food to eat, and, you know, I'm not going to, you know, be swimming in a river full of leeches and parasites.
I remember Robin Benincasa talking about being at the Ironman, and everybody at the meeting was asking about, okay, there was an earthquake and there's a crack in the road. How big's a crack? Can we get across a crack? What's going to happen with the crack? And she goes, Bob, all I know is after doing adventure racing, I know that around 12 hours, I will have a drink with an umbrella in it. Right.
Yeah.
And you're going to and people are going to be handing me food every 5 miles. This is, you know, this is a catered workout. Right. So, you know, when you're and I'm sure you've been there, when you're in a foreign country and you're on a rope that is basically being shredded by the rock that you're climbing up at that moment, none of that other stuff really is a big deal.
Yeah, it makes the nerves at, you know, a start line, you know, of a normal race seem kind of silly. They're like, what am I nervous about? If I'm going to be faster than this person next to me or not, or, you know, it is definitely perspective.
Love it. So when you set out to write Rush to Glory, I mean, I bet it was one of those things that, you know, you day to day, you remember stories, you remember little glimpses of things that happened. How fun was it for you to look back and remember, oh, my God, I forgot about that, and just to really capture all of the great stories from all of these different events?
You know, it's if nothing happens with this book, and I'll tell you, I hated the process in the middle of it. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I was, why am I doing this? But absolutely, if nothing else happens, it was a really, really valuable trip down memory lane to call up old friends, to look at old pictures, to watch old Eco Challenge videotapes. You know, I had to buy a VCR player to like play these things and watch them. And it was a very great life lesson of just, man, I've done some cool stuff. And
exactly.
I don't think we look back enough. The lesson that I'm really taking from it is we're always looking, oh, what race am I doing next? What achievement am I going to do? Okay, great. What's next? Instead of kind of the reverse bucket list, looking back and going, man, I did some cool stuff. That was awesome. And I think we all could, you know, value from looking back and kind of patting ourselves on the shoulders and reconnecting with friends more often.
So was that the cathartic part of this, looking back and reconnecting? Were you able to reconnect with Mark Burnett?
Yeah, Mark Burnett wrote the foreword to the book, which was really cool. He said some really nice things.
Awesome.
Connected with Robin Benincasa, who was one of my teammates, and there's a story about her in the book. And you know, even my old high school running coach, the man who first introduced me to organized athletics, you know, we had a long chat too. And it was great to actually go back to all those people and say thank you, first of all. And, man, wasn't that awesome? And those were good times. And so it definitely was the best part of the process for sure.
So how does a Chicago girl end up in Ketchum, Idaho?
Yeah, let's see.
That's chapters 12 through 16.
You know, that's sort of in the Vinny. But, yeah, I mean, Chicago was a great place to grow up in the suburbs, and, I had a great upbringing. But what happened is I worked at a health club in downtown Chicago that had a rock climbing wall, and that's the first time I was sort of introduced to outdoor sports. You know, as a kid, we went camping, but I learned to rock climb inside and was just like, oh, man, this is pretty cool. And it just really sort of the adventure bug was kind of was born there, I think. And so the rock climbing is really what launched me out of Chicago. And so I ended up, you know, doing a big climbing trip, headed west and visited a lot of places, and then kind of just ended up staying where the rock climbing was, which was out in California at the time for me.
Yeah.
Opened a rock gym and met a bunch of people, started paddling, you know, and that adventure racing fell into it. And then I lived in my car for probably a while.
Did you,
you
really?
Know, 5 years. Yeah,
five years or so, in your car?
I was like, you know, I just had to wander. I had wanderlust. I was adventure racing. I couldn't, you know, I wanted to do all these trips, but the only way to afford it is if I didn't have a roof over my head. So lived out of my car and stayed with friends and really just to kind of follow that little dream. And it brought me here to a teammate lived here in Ketchum, Idaho. One of my main adventure racing teammates, Patrick Harper.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited this place and that was 12 years ago and I never left. So it became home.
And
for the first time in my life, I live in a house that I own, and you know, I finally like
no
become a grown
way.
Up.
No way. Do you find yourself looking at the minivan and going, "Oh man, there's lots of good room in there"?
You know, I got really sad when I sold my Ford Bronco. It was a 1975 Ford Bronco. I sold it just a couple years ago, and that was the rig that I lived in. And I was like, "Man," and I cried when she drove away. And
yeah.
I was like, does this? This is the end of my adventurous life, like driving away right now and I have a house and like a mortgage. And, you know, it was kind of a soul searching. And now I'm just, instead of the adventures are just taking place from my house and I leave from here and I have a place to unpack. So that's the only difference. It hasn't really slowed down the adventures, which is cool.
So you haven't.
I have a car that runs better and, you know, I have a roof over my head.
So you haven't really become a grown up. You're just doing grown-up stuff.
No, not really. I just have a garage to put all my toys in.
Okay.
Really
cool. Okay. So, like you said, you teamed up with Robin Benincasa, and it's funny. Robin was there when, you know, Mark Burnett did the first tryout for Team American Pride, and, you know, she was part of that whole group with her and Kathy Sasson and some of the early female adventure racers. What was special about being a teammate with Robin?
You know, Robin and Kathy were both, you know, original mentors and teammates and the two people who really kind of encouraged me to get involved and saying, you know, there's not many women in this sport. We think you have something special. You should get involved. And ended up being able to team up with them for a 3-woman, 1-man race for the Eco Challenge in Argentina. And I was a rookie. I mean, I'd only done one expedition adventure race at the time, but I had sponsorship, and I had they had changed the rules that year. Mark Burnett, it was the first year he had a nationality rule that required you're all from one nation for a team.
Oh.
And Kathy and Robin had Robin was racing with Kiwis, Kathy was racing with French team, Ian was racing also with Kiwis and Aussies, and so all of a sudden it's like all the best people in the sport had no home. And so I pitched to them, and I'm like, hey, I want to do this women's team, will you do it with me? And it was totally audacious of me to ask the best in the sport, but they were all like, yeah, that sounds cool. We would love to do a women's team and show people, you know, how strong women are. And we finished fourth that year and beat a ton of men's teams. And it was an amazing experience for me. I talk about it in the book, but I was such a new adventure racer at the time, and these were my heroes. And
right.
To be able to go alongside them and kind of be able to hang was pretty awesome, and it was definitely my crash course in adventure racing.
The hardest part to me is, you know, you can learn to do a lot of skills. I don't know how you learn to be a good navigator. It seems to me that's either you have that or you don't have that, and that's really, at the end of the day, that's the most important role on the team, right?
It is the most important role in the team, because if you could be going nowhere fast, and it doesn't really matter if you're going in the wrong direction. So yeah, navigation was a huge kind of separator. And you know, I've raced with a number of navigators, but Ian Adamson was definitely one of the best in the world. Patrick Harper, who I also raced with. If you're going to go 350 miles over the course of a week, you don't want to go 351 miles. You don't want to go, you know, 357 miles. You don't want to go one step out of your way. But because the courses are not marked, you choose. You go over that mountain or around, you know, and sometimes the shortest way is not the fastest way. And that's what I loved about the sport, was how cerebral it was and how much you had to think and strategize instead of just the gun goes off and you get to the end as fast as you can along this dotted line. Adventure racing was much more cerebral and teamwork. You know, the second biggest thing besides navigating was how you get along as a team. And always, you know, often the most fit people were not the winning teams. It was the teams that could work together and maximize everybody's potential.
So when you talk about cerebral, a lot of people are cerebral when they've slept 8 hours. But that same person who hasn't slept in 3 days, it can be a moron. So, you know, trying to get by, because when I look at the attraction of adventure racing, I never got into it because cold, wet, lost, hungry, those aren't things I'm looking to, you know, to pay money to go do. being, you know, did you find that you were, I know Robin was someone who seemed like she did better, right? The less sleep she had, the more functional she was. But for someone like yourself, was that a strength for you?
Yeah, and I think this goes back with kind of what you said people are born with. You know, you're born with that kind of suffering gene, I think, or not. You know, you see it in really successful mountaineers, adventure racers, expedition-type people, the ability to just
to hurt,
keep going when it sucks, you know, and to just put your head down and plod along and keep going. It's something that you can hone, but I really think you're kind of either born with it or you're not, and it's always been my forte. The longer, the better. I mean, it's even in high school, you know, I was on the running team, and I was better at cross-country than I was at track. You know, anything that was longer and you didn't know what was around the next corner, I excelled in. And even when I transitioned from adventure racing to mountain bike racing, I mean, I looked for the longest thing I could find mountain biking, and that was 24-hour mountain bike racing, which for me was a sprint, you know, going from 7 days to 24 hours.
Yeah,
I mean, mountain bike people, they're like, oh, it's so long. I'm like, no, it's only one day. You know, like, Robin, I'm going to have a bed and a meal and a burger and a beer in less than 24 hours. Like,
And especially those lapped courses where they've got couches out there and they got a big screen and they're, you know, they're relaying. And I remember, I can't remember who was the first guy to go, I think I'll do it on my own. And we were like, oh my God, he's going to ride 100 miles by himself on one day, which seems really brutal until you're going across Borneo with leeches hanging on to spots that you really don't want them hanging on to.
It's a cool story, that 24-hour story. That was John Stamstead, was the first one to do one of those solo.
Yeah.
And what he did, it was not allowed. So he entered his name, you know, Jonathan T. Stamstead, J. Stamstead. You know, he entered his name four different ways and just did it himself. It's pretty awesome.
I love that. So that's one of the stories that you tell in the book?
I don't talk about John Stamstead, but I definitely talk about 24-hour
racing.
I have 3 world championships in that.
Yes.
And, you know, it's really launched. That launched my second career after adventure racing, which was this unexpected cycling career. I wasn't planning on that, but that's sort of phase two of the professional athlete part.
So did that lead to the 24-hour stuff lead to Leadville?
Yep. I sort of have been going shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. Leadville, same thing. You know, 24 hours led to Leadville, 100 miler, and same thing. I'm like, 100 miles? All right. Sweet, that's short. I can do that. So it's interesting, as a lot of people, you know, as they age as an athlete, they go longer and longer. But I've been actually changing my training to work on speed work and intervals and, you know, 1 minute on, 1 minute off, which is a total departure from what I was doing training for adventure racing.
In adventure racing, it's one day on, one day off.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but are you still working as a firefighter and EMT as well?
I am. I'm part-time with the Ketchum Fire Department and the Backcountry Rescue Team, and I love that. That was plan B if this whole sports thing didn't work out, was to go to paramedic school. But, yeah, I'm an EMT and work with the fire department, and it's fun crossover training, and there's nothing cooler than driving a fire engine around and, you know, turning the sirens on. And it's something to give back to my community. It's really fun.
So with Leadville, for people who don't know about the Leadville 100, what makes it special?
That race, I'm like, why this race? Why is everybody so into this race? And it's, you know, one, it starts at 10,000 feet, 10,200. That's the lowest that you'll go in the race.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And so just the extreme nature. One, yes, you're riding 100 miles, but you're doing it above 10,000 feet. And the really special thing, I have to say, and it's something I feel about the place I live, too, is the community there in Leadville. It's this hard-working, crusty community, and they really kind of embrace people who are willing to hang themselves out there and try something really hard. And so, you know, the race really matches kind of the small-town working mentality and it's a really special place. And the history of it, I mean, that race was launched when all the mines closed. I think like 50% of the town lost their jobs all in one day. And Ken Klober, the race director, he had been working in the mines, and he basically launched the 100-mile run as like, okay, we're gonna put this town on the map for something else other than mining. And, yeah. You know, everyone thought he was crazy, and that was in the 80s. And from the run came the bike, and now they host a series of events in town, and it's become a really popular recreation destination for extreme high-altitude endurance events.
So that race has probably done more to put you on the public map than anything else, because I think when Lance went they did a film on that, and all of a sudden Leadville was a big deal, and then you're winning the thing four times. It's like, oh, wait a second.
I happened to waltz in the year that Lance won, and nobody knew who I was. You know, 24-hour mountain bike racing. Yeah, I'd won world championships three times, but it's not really on the public radar.
Nope.
And so, yeah, I waltzed in, total unknown, rode the bike race. Great, won the women's event unexpectedly, and next thing I know, I'm standing on a podium next to Lance Armstrong, and, you know, Sports Illustrated, and I'm in a picture just by standing next to him, you know. I was like photobombing, sort of, I guess, but yeah, they had to put us both in the photos, and I was like, wow, okay, here we go. And so I went back the next year and, you know, won again and shared the podium with Levi Leipheimer. And then the next year shared the podium with Todd Wells. So, you know, it's definitely, one, it's put the women's race on the map, which is really cool, but it absolutely kind of revitalized, you know, my cycling career, and it was a very unexpected but really awesome boost to keep doing what I love to do.
Now, when did you realize that you could suffer more than the next gal, that you had that gene of, okay, the tougher this gets, I've got another gear, I can go longer and harder than the other folks?
I think, I had a little glimpse of it in high school running. You know, when it got longer, I seemed to do better. But it really was the adventure racing that, you know, kind of opened my eyes to that. And people saying, oh, you should try this. But it wasn't really until I raced alongside the heroes in the sport, you know, Robin and Kathy and Ian, and kept up with them, that I was like, whoa, okay, maybe somebody's onto something here. And, I mean, you never think you're special. Like, I don't sit here and go, man, I'm so awesome. I'm so special.
Yes, but then when you can keep up
with your mentors and you can actually keep up, you're like, oh, maybe I am okay at this. So that was really, that race in Argentina with them was really an eye-opener for me that, you know, people hadn't been feeding me a line of bull, you know, saying, oh, you're really good. I had to see it with my own two eyes.
Well, and also what you see is, you know, from the outside, you're thinking these guys are, you know, they're immortal. They're just like, they go up the mountain and they smile and they laugh and ha 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 and they stomp everybody. But when you're teammates with them, you can see them suffer. You can see there's times that, wow, you know what? They're starting to crumble here a little bit, and they're like me. Everybody's got highs and lows, and I can handle it the same way they can.
It's so true. There is this expectation or this belief that, you know, it's easy for the pros, or, oh, somebody goes and wins Ironman and they're not hurting. But, you know,
we
the pros
know,
are hurting as much or more, probably continuously at a higher level of pain than probably the average Joe. But people assume that because someone's at that level that it's not hard, and that's just completely wrong.
Are you surprised at, you know, where your career has come from, you know, gal running, you know, track and cross country in Chicago to really being a superstar in what you do, right? And you're in winning Leadville four times, and now you've got your own book out there. I'm sure you didn't set out to go, okay, I'm going to become a professional athlete.
No, I'm totally shocked, actually, and I kind of feel like one day somebody's going to discover, you know, that this is all a big farce or something. I mean, when I fill out a form and ask for your occupation or whatever, I kind of laugh when I put professional athlete, because no, I never dreamed this. I didn't plan this career, and really I just kept doing stuff that was fun for me and followed my passion. But unlike my sister in high school, she knew she wanted to be a dentist, she wanted to be in the medical field. And she went down that road, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing next week, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, we've both succeeded in our careers by following our passion, but with me not knowing what the hell I wanted to do, and my sister knowing very decisively, I want to follow this path. So it's, I mean, it's awesome, but I'm totally shocked. But it's also been, I'll be totally honest with you, a lot of hard work and, you know, no job security, not knowing where the next paycheck's going to come from. And so the fact that I can pay a mortgage and have a garage and, you know, live somewhere amazing is I feel like I've finally really made it at age, you know, 46. Here I am, you know.
And getting better.
Finally.
Getting better. Next thing you know, you're going to be doing 100-yard sprints, right?
I don't know. I
love that. So was there a point, like you said, your sister knew exactly what you wanted to do from high school. And here's Rebecca living in her car. Were there points where the family was going, Rebecca, you know, maybe you should, you know, like get one of those real job things? Or did you ever get any of that family type pressure to, okay, Rebecca, why don't you figure out what you want to do?
I'm sure that they were thinking that. They never really told me.
They didn't tell
you.
That's good. That's good.
You know, and, the, you know, my mom is kind of, she gets that question a lot. And, you know, what her answer is like, look, Rebecca never asked me for money. You know, she wasn't on drugs. She, you know, she was doing fine, you know, and she was happy and healthy and, you know, not mooching off of me. So she was okay with that. And then I think they really started to understand when Eco Challenge went on TV and they actually saw me on TV.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, cool, Rebecca's on TV. That's awesome.
Love
that. I mean, I still wasn't making a reasonable paycheck, but I was making it work with odd jobs and, you know, working at coffee shops and teaching skiing. But I made it work. And I think now, I mean, obviously they look at the book and they're like, wow, you really did have some. I mean, that was the feat of endurance, is actually sustaining a career like this that was very unknown and, you know, not a lot of job security, like I said.
You know, it's interesting. I put the other book last year, just sort of a collection of my articles from over the years. And when I was doing it, I'm going, you know what, I just want to, I've got this stuff scattered all over the place, and I just sort of want to put it in one place. And if I do three copies, one for me and, you know, one for my family, I'm fine, right? And I'm guessing this was, that might have been something that led to you writing this, going, you know, if I don't do it now and put all this stuff in one place, I'm not going to remember all this stuff.
There was part of that, but, you know, people have been saying to me for years, oh, you should write a book, you should write a book. And I was like, no, I'm not a writer. Who wants to hear my story? And it really wasn't until, I mean, I had thought about it and talked to some people about it, but quite honestly, Velo Press came to me and said, hey, have you thought about writing a book? We want a female athlete, author. And it did kind of land in my lap. And so that was really the push I needed to be like, you know what, I better do this now or never.
Yeah.
You know, I might never find a publisher again. And so that was, they really pushed me into it, which was great. I probably would have put it off another few years without a deadline.
Love that. And Rush to Glory, it's out now?
It is out now, yep. It's online on Amazon, on my website, and it's out in the world. I just had a great launch at Interbike. And
yes, you were. I know you were at a number of the booths there and doing some appearances. So really, you've had nice response on the book already, right?
It's been really good. I mean, it, part of it, you know, literally my life is an open book now. And, you know, it's quite honest book. I think there are things that, you know, even my family didn't know that were in that book. And so it's honest. But what I really hope, you know, what people take from it is not necessarily learning all about me. But I want people to read that and get inspired to do their own adventures and be like, you know what? This kid with asthma from Chicago can go do all this stuff. You know, I can get off my butt and I can go do something cool too. Even if your adventure is a 5K or it's to climb Kilimanjaro or whatever it is, I hope people take their own inspiration from it.
So hopefully one of these days, Mark Burnett will quit doing this dumb TV stuff and decide to do one more Eco Challenge, one more.
I would be so in for a reunion trip. I mean, we've talked about it with all writing this book. Everyone's like, yeah, we got to do it again.
Exactly. I love it. That was an awesome sport, you know, awesome sport, 300 miles. And what I loved about it was you had the leaders like you guys, you know, carrying cut-off toothbrushes. And I remember Robin told me the first time she packed for a thing, she like packed clothes for 3 weeks or something. And then it gets to the point where you, okay, I got a shirt, I got a sort of a pair of jeans, shorts. I'm good. You have nothing.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, when you watch it on TV, there's the leaders, and then 3 days behind them is the guy with the toaster oven, who's rappelling across some, you know, who's rappelling across some gorge, and he's got a 50-pound or 60-pound pack on his back trying to get across. So that. That, you know, you sort of had the everyday guys, and then you had the racers. And I just love, you know, same with Iron Man. You love the mix of the elites and the everyday folks.
You know, and that's what's cool about any sport is, yeah, you see all of humanity from the first to the last person, but we are the same in that we're all putting ourselves out there. We're all suffering. We're all trying hard. We're all celebrating at the finish line, whether you're that first person, you know, world champion, or you're the last person who, you know, is on their own personal journey. We are all kind of the same.
Love that. Hey, Rebecca, thanks so much for taking so much time. It's always, always nice to catch up with you. Love what you've brought
to the
sport. Always love your enthusiasm. And again, the book is called Rush to Glory.
That's what it's about, right?
Enthusiasm is what it's about. Rebecca Rush, R-U-S-C-H. And what's the website, Rebecca?
RebeccaRush.com, or you can also find the book on VeloPress.
On VeloPress. I love it. Again, you are listening to Babbittville Radio, and we're brought to you by Cal1020.com. 10 miles, 20 bands coming up on February 15th, 2015. Core Sports for the very best in women's active wear. Challenge Athletes Foundation, our San Diego Triathlon Challenge, where we've raised over $55 million, coming up on October 19th. And you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes on Babbittville Radio. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.